This is the PT Pintcast, a podcast that talks about physical therapy over beer, bringing together clinicians, researchers, and forward-thinking PTs in a show that's anything but boring.
Let there be beer!
This is the PT Pintcast with your host, Jimmy McKay.
All right, here we go with another episode of the PT Pintcast. The best conversations happen at happy hour. Welcome to ours. Want to say thanks to everybody who's been following us on Facebook and Twitter at PT Pintcast, and for checking out the newly designed website at ptpintcast.com. That was created by my classmate and fellow PT student, Tom Stormer. Now, tonight's guest, buckle your safety belts. Her education and professional career has been almost exclusively at WashU in St. Louis. She has a BS in PT and a PhD in neurobiology. She worked as a neuro PT for 9 years before getting that PhD. As a faculty member, she taught neuroscience and musculoskeletal disorders, as well as seeing patients with musculoskeletal pain. Faculty member for 57 years before her retirement 2 years ago, and apparently she's not slowing down. She still participates in lab meetings and consults on research projects, as well as traveling nationally and internationally, lecturing in conferences and teaching continuing education programs on the movement system impairment syndromes. She's written a book, Diagnosis and Treatment of Movement Impairment Syndromes, and edited a second book on movement system impairment syndromes of the cervical and thoracic spine and the extremities. She actually trained monkeys and recorded from their motor cortex for 19 years. We've got to get into that. She has two dogs, Toby and Louise. We welcome Shirley Salmon to the PT Pintcast. Shirley, thank you for coming on the show.
Now, how did you know about my dogs? I didn't say anything about them.
I do not have Shirley Salmon on my show and not do my homework. Wanted to say thank you very much for taking the time and talking to us and just sharing some knowledge with the PT community. We appreciate it.
I welcome the opportunity to have a chance to discuss some of my perspectives with you all.
Well, sounds good. I try to have a different beer with each episode, so I try to change it up. This one's from Michigan, Bell's Brewery. It's the Bell's Best Brown Ale.
You should be drinking Busch, because this is, I'm in St. Louis.
St. Louis, you got to stick with the
local. The home of Anheuser-Busch, formerly.
So where do you want to start? You spent years
with the beer, or?
Oh, no. I'm past that. I'm back.
You know
back,
where to go.
I'm back to you.
Okay.
So here's something that I've heard, and I'm a third-year student, just kind of got into PT in the last couple of years, and all I hear is that PTs, we're movement experts. And that's a relatively new statement, but not for you. You've been saying this for a long time.
Mm. Yes. Really intensely for a mere 30 years, but kind of realized it for 57. Yes.
So you spent a while trying to get other people to accept that PTs are experts of the movement system, and then we need to adopt the identity as experts of movement, or we're not going to get any traction. You want to talk about that a little bit?
You know, Jimmy, it's just really become so clear. When I started my career, I actually started when there were polio patients. I came in at the end of the polio era. So I've seen this progression, tail end of the lower motor neuron problem to the upper motor neuron problem. And ironically, here I am in musculoskeletal pain problems. The whole idea of that time when I started, I just felt like a medical cheerleader. Just as long as I was enthusiastic and had enough strength to drag people around, I was doing my job. And then it just became so clear what physical therapy had to offer. But in some ways, we're handicapped by having the title therapist, handicapped by tradition of having somebody else figure out what it was we treated, and we were supposed to just go deliver the service after they figured it out. Well, it didn't take too many hemiplegic patients for me to realize the physicians had no idea what was wrong with their disordered motor control. And then I slowly began to realize it was the same thing with musculoskeletal pain. And yet, spending the time that I was doing my monkey business, I was actually half-time in the Department of Neurology. So associating with physicians that intensely, it really became clear that their claim to fame was having expertise in a system of the body. So you know what a neurologist does? They take care of the nervous system. You know what a cardiologist does. You know what a dentist does? But who knows what a PT does?
That's a good point.
It's a critical one. So people outside in the public, in fact, even within the healthcare system, look to people who have expertise in a body system. And then when you think it through, there is no thing that's more important than movement, whether you're talking about synaptic release, the mechanical events that trigger the things of atrophy or hypertrophy in a muscle, or you're talking about adding weights or walking around, and that our expertise comes from understanding all of the systems that contribute to movement, and yet being able to analyze movement. So that to me is number one, is that if people understood that there was a movement system and we make a case for how critical it is to everything and that we have this expertise, then that would start to move us out of this role of just being therapists who don't get bored by counting to 10. And then the other thing that goes along with that, the neurologist makes neurological diagnosis.
Right.
The cardiologist makes cardiac diagnosis. We should be making movement system diagnosis. One of the things that is indeed another handicap for us is that we don't have diagnostic manuals. I often think that the difference between an expert and a novice is pattern recognition. Two things impede us. I mean, if you think of it this other way, is that physicians shorten that time to become experts by using diagnostic categories, and they learn all the patterns that go with a specific diagnosis. And here's the other, I think, important point is medical students take pathophysiology to understand the diagnosis they make, not to make a diagnosis. And we kind of think that we can march through testing systems and then come up with some kind of label, even though we've never agreed to what that label is, nor have we spelled out patterns. So everybody has to have at least 30 years of experience before they have their patterns, and then they can keep them a secret from everybody else too. I just think we've handicapped ourselves by not moving on with the idea of having diagnosis that direct our treatment. And I'm fully aware of the multiple versions of there's kind of and there is kind of not a lot of different diagnoses out there. I don't care what they are. We just have to get labeling them. And the other handicap is I teach a lot of continuing education programs. And what I'm pretty well aware of is that people don't have a set exam that they perform on patients. So even if they had 5 low back pain patients in one day, they would use a different exam with every patient.
Right.
Well, you can't see patterns that way, and you
right.
can't become efficient that way. And then when we look at most of our continuing ed courses, they're all about treatment. They're not about figuring out the condition. Jumping back to the diagnosis issue, no one will think we figure anything out until you put a label on it. So to me, all of these things fit together that physicians have been successful because of the procedures that they have set up. They claim an expertise in a body system. They have diagnosis of that system. The world thinks they know all about how that system functions normally, and then they use tests to confirm or disconfirm, and then they order drugs or recommend surgery.
Jim, this is pretty much the driving force behind your system and your book, The Diagnosis and Treatment of Movement Impairment Syndromes. This does it twofold. Number one, it gets us all on the same page as PTs in terms of doing the same thing and seeing a pattern. Number two, it does what you were just talking about. It lets the world know what we actually do and what system we're in charge of.
Right. To me, that's one person's version of movement system diagnosis. And you have others, the McKenzie system, the treatment-based classification system. Peter O'Sullivan has got a system. I don't care what system it is, as long as people use the labels. And I have no worry that the most efficient system will sort itself out in the long run, as long as we're doing that. And my impression is that most of our educational programs and practitioners use special tests. Special tests, physicians don't even rely on them because they're not very reliable
right.
or very valid. And then what are you going to do, operate? I mean, and there's numerous things happening right now where a physician world is really recognizing that, oh, it may not be that your clavicle is too big giving you a shoulder impingement syndrome. It may be that you don't move right. Whoa, how exciting is that?
Right.
All of these structural variations in the hip, clearly the majority of papers right now are saying this is from excessive loading from intensive sports during your still growing years, which can last up to age 22. How is that going to be modified by looking at movement, loading, etc.? It just seems to me that we're ripe to go out there. The other thing that in some ways we kind of lost for a number of years is our expertise in exercise. Clearly, as I was discussing with some physicians and scientists actually on Monday, when they say, well, you don't have much evidence for what you do. And I said, there's a lot of evidence that exercise fixes a whole lot of things, doesn't have many side effects, it's not costly, doesn't destroy your liver or your kidney, and you don't have to be one out of the 32 people that has an effect with. We have support for that, but we're not the ones that the world looks to for exercise, except if you've had your knee replaced or your hip replaced, but not for general exercise, not for the kind that helps your brain and helps you prevent cancer, the whole nine yards that exercise does.
Now, sure, you've been around in PT for 57 years, and you just brought up a point that I've heard several PTs say is that we're not necessarily experts on exercise. Where did we lose that along the way, or did we ever own it?
Well, we sort of owned it. The polio patient, clearly, and also during World War II, even part of the World War I, they were called reconstruction aides, the early physical therapists, and most of them were physical education people or nurses. So exercise was a big part of the treatment for these people. This is always, like everything, there's a roller coaster. The good and the bad come together. So the good part of, I kind of call it, we had these eras. And one of the eras we moved into was really manipulative or manual therapy, which certainly had a lot of positive effects because that was really the first time that people started thinking about some kind of exam, figuring out what was wrong, where before, in fact, I think it wasn't until about 1995 that we got paid by Medicare for doing an exam because the physician had done it first. We didn't need to do one because it had been done by the doctor. So anyway, so manual therapy kind of did that sort of thing. But it moved us into passive treatment instead of active treatment. That was sort of the...
Is that where we kind of lost it?
Yeah, right. And before, for musculoskeletal pain, it was kind of heavy on modalities. And to be a real realist, part of why physical therapy grew so is that we were a cash cow. In the early 1980s, the average physical therapist gave to a patient ultrasound. That was $55. E-stim, hot packs, massage, therapeutic exercise was $15. It was the cheapest.
Wow.
But everybody got everything because you were paid for procedures. So things got lost, so to speak. There was a bigger emphasis on what were you doing that could help benefit bottom line. Time with patients, emphasis on exercise really got lost. To me, that's sort of tragic. I know, again, in teaching continuing education courses, I could say safely that not 10% of people in the room really understand how the abdominal muscles function and how you should test them and what the best exercise programs are. It's just not there. Even though I know it taught that in school, but it's not valued when you get into the clinical practice.
Right. We have more and more information. We're now to the doctoral degree, but we've lost something that was the crux of what this profession started with.
That's my point. We also were, many ways, mainly the neurological patient where we worried about movement, not the musculoskeletal. In fact, I think I kind of serendipitously got involved with that because I started, I mean, if people would have said, Shirley, you're going to be running around talking about patients with back pain, I would have said, you know, I think you've been drinking too much, or you just had a stroke or something really crazy, because I was going to solve the problems of the upper motor neuron syndrome.
Right.
But anyway, I started giving runners in that similar exercises to what I had stroke patients doing. I was teaching them how to walk differently, et cetera, and they got better, and I had like not a clue why they did.
Right.
So then I had to start sort of sorting it out. Thank heavens for the Australians, who did a lot of research looking at muscle function and movement and motor control, move things more and more into the control aspects and a bit into movement. They're not quite at movement. They're more at looking at the muscle thing. But one of my colleagues, Linda Van Dillen, who's doing research on low back subjects, has really demonstrated that if you teach people with low back pain to keep their spine still during all of their basic activities, their pain scores go down for 6 months. So, and that's what I look for, is how are people not moving precisely, and how can we change that around? And I think now with this adoption of an identity, and that I was first on a work group, a board work group, and now on the task force for the movement system, everybody that's been on it is in agreement that we really need to jump on this bandwagon of we really analyze movement. And to me, through this full scope of whether you want to think about it passively, looking at a joint, or you want to look at active joint movement, or you want to look at how man's moving in his environment, all aspects through all levels. That's what we should be about.
We talk about people jumping on that bandwagon. That's not really a bandwagon. That's like your train that you've been on for a number of years, right? This is your boat. We're just sailing on it.
Well, it's just because I'm old enough to remember it and too boring to change my ways. So, You know, I always love telling young people when you're young, they call it stubborn and obnoxious. And when you're older, it's perseverant and tenacious. So take patience, parents.
I like that
a lot. Those stubborn kids have something ahead of them.
I like that. Well, you touched on your start in neuro, and you actually trained monkeys and recorded from their motor cortex for 19 years. What was
that
like?
I didn't push back any frontiers of ignorance. That was... I learned a lot about monkeys, and I learned a lot about training.
What were you looking for?
I mean, my research to try to uncover this disordered motor control in monkeys. It's in the upper motor neuron syndrome. I work with a neurologist that was head of neurology. He was my PhD dissertation advisor, and we had a common interest in stroke and the disordered motor control. So the idea was to, because you couldn't put a hole in their head and then record from them, so we recorded from them. And when we started, there was a general belief that upper motor neurons in the cortex behave very similarly to lower motor neurons in the spinal cord. So they'd be related to, let's say, dorsiflexors or plantar flexors, or they'd be related to small force or large force or whatever. And when we found out, first of all, it isn't that way.
Right.
I am so convinced that the brain does what you train it to do. It's like a basic program, and you fill in the details. It's like a platform. That's why I don't get excited when people find, oh, pain changes your brain. Of course it does. Everything changes your brain. If you rub your skin for a little while, your brain gets changed. If you do passive motion, your brain changes. The brain's very adaptive. It's just making it adapt sort of the right way. So anyway, number one, we couldn't get a good population of those cells that we could then find out how they changed. We still did some lesions in the descending cortical spinal tract and then recorded from the monkey. And as I say, I didn't push back any big frontiers of ignorance doing that work. It was very time-consuming. It took almost a year to train the monkeys. Wow. The studies that people did before were always in the hand, and we were using the foot so that we would have room for the lesion. And the monkeys, in many ways, didn't realize they had a lesion. their little brain adapted, and we weren't sure how the cells in the cortex adapted to it.
Yeah, well, I'm taking neuro rehabilitation right now with Julie Reese, and that's pretty much exactly what we're learning in class.
Yeah, well, you know, the big problem is with the stroke patient type thing is those cells are gone.
Right, a lot of damage.
Yeah, I mean, so you can't retrain what isn't there. You can use other subsystems, but those subsystems don't have the capability that the upper motor. See, actually, a colleague that's not really at WashU anymore, but we worked on diagnostic categories also for neurological patients. Part of it was because I knew after 9 years of treating patients that when I walked into a room, I could pretty well tell whether the patient was going to get recovery or not. I never wanted to admit it because I thought I'd pull off the miracle that would change things around. But you kind of knew. So again, we tried to describe those patterns so that people would be setting appropriate goals for neurological patients as well. This whole idea of classification and guiding treatment is something that we have to do across all the spectrums of patients that we see.
Non-PT question coming at you right now.
Yep.
All right. So you've gone nationally and you've lectured internationally. You can't pick St. Louis. Where's your favorite favorite place to go within the U.S. and where's your favorite place to go internationally?
Those are actually two easy answers because every summer I go to Vail, Colorado for a month. I just love being in the mountains and I take those two dogs.
Yeah.
And just be there and walk and hike and hopefully do some writing. We're working on the second edition of the first book now. And the other place that I really like a lot is Sydney, Australia.
Oh, yeah.
I just love the Opera House and the setting there by the Botanical Gardens and Darling Harbour and all that. You can walk through all of that area. Those are my favorites.
Once I'm done with PT school, that's my goal, is to get down under and really check out Australia. A local PT here is actually from Australia, a guy named Scott Epsley, and he's like, I've got your trip all mapped out for you, where you're going to go.
Oh, how great.
So I'm looking forward to that. Besides the movement system, one thing that you're big on is that PTs should be lifespan practitioners, you know, performing
absolutely
a yearly exam. And I love this little way to put it. Never discharge a patient, but you just end a particular episode of care. And this is actually something that's coming up more often amongst the PT community.
I hope so. It needs to be. See, that's, again, it falls right under that movement system. What we can do, I kind of call it the dental model. You know, as soon as you get your teeth, you start going to the dentist and you continue even after you don't have them anymore. And what you're doing is just making sure you're brushing them. I mean, but we have even more to do because, to me, when we're talking about movement system, it means, number one, are you lined up right? Because in spite of the way people position themselves and posture and dress, et cetera, it makes a difference. You're not going to be a premier athlete if you are bent out of shape. And if you are, you aren't going to last long. Number two is, do you have the right aerobic capacity? Is your strength right? Have you identified your structural variations? Because if you have femoral antiversion, career as a ballerina is not for you. It's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. What are those structural variations where you can be guided into an activity that won't compromise your musculoskeletal system or your longevity at participating in it? And then, because very clear that it's moving that induces the loss of precise movement, your activities, everything from daily activities to sports activities, alter the precision of your movement. You need to be rechecked so that you can get that straightened out to keep up optimal performance. See, I really believe we're going to be able to demonstrate that we're the people that can slow down osteoarthritis. I think of physicians as taking care of symptoms and consequences. We're the people. We're not going to prevent it any more than they prevent stroke. Most of the patients I saw in the 60s were 65 years old. Now you're 80 because they're taking care of hypertension. You're going to get osteoarthritis in some people earlier, but we could slow down some of this development by appropriate care. I participated in a conference in Chicago about 4 weeks ago now, and it was very interesting. It was organized by Paul Hodges in conjunction with the North American Spine Society. And the evidence is really getting clear that musculoskeletal pain is an ongoing progressive condition. And there are changes at the muscular level, peripheral and central nervous systems. For people to be believing that it's a self-limiting condition and in 4 weeks, all will be well and you will be fully restored is a fantasy. It's a total fantasy. And that's why we can't discharge people. They should not only come in every year, they have a flare-up of some sort. They should be able to bebop in and get them straightened out again. It makes sense that we can optimize the development of the system. We can monitor what's happening, try and keep people functioning optimally. To me, this is going to be the necessary change in our business model, because I don't think our business model is going to continue to work in the way that it has. That's why I want to sort of take back exercise, because if people, I don't want to be the one counting to 10, but I want to be the one that says, this is what you need to do. These are some suggested ways. And if there's a personal trainer you want to work with, that's great. These are your guidelines. And then come back and we'll check you out.
How do we get there? When you say it like that with a dental model, I mean, it makes complete sense, but how do we get there in American society?
To me, it's one, just like the dentist have been able to publicize how important it is that your teeth are straight and that you brush them every day.
Yeah.
You know, and you only speak and eat with them. And we,
it's a good point.
You know, you use your whole body for everything. And it makes a difference on how you appear to how you can function and how comfortable you are and how soon your pain comes on. My God, it's just, to me, a little bit more of publicizing that, getting us out of this role of having somebody else figure out that you need to come to a PT. And that's why I'm so keen on the labels, because I don't think people will know we're figuring anything out until we put a label on. And I think even other healthcare practitioners, it's big. And here's the other thing that I think is a door open for us. It's all over the paper in the news, the drug addiction problem. Mm-hmm. And, you know, 50% of those people are medically induced. Why? Because they're giving pain medication. Now, I can understand it for cancers and all the rest, but not musculoskeletal pain. And so if people knew that we could modify pain by how people move or stand, in fact, one of the really fun times I have is every year I give a lecture to the first year medical students. It's in their basic muscle physiology course. And I try my best to scare them to death about their exercise program. And by the time I'm about 20 minutes into it, they're all sitting up straight in their chairs. So this year, I decided I wanted to do an exam because I figured these people will never see the opportunity of watching somebody's pain modified just during the course of changing their alignment or doing an exam. So I asked the course master. He said, oh, that's fine. I was hoping you would. So I got this medical student up there, and I could tell he really was kind of getting up there. He had back pain, but he wanted to show off because he was all buffed up. I could tell he was a big weightlifter. So his pain was 4 out of 5, and he was in a marked anterior tilt because his hip flexors were a bit overdeveloped. And so I said, okay, so standing here, what's your pain? He said, 4 out of 5. And I said, put your feet apart. How's it now? He said, well, I don't have any. I said, I know. Oh, I got such fun out of that. You know, so I went on to show all these relationships. And that's my point, is that if you're a medical student going through, somebody comes in, they got back pain. Well, if we don't get an MRI, there's this medication you can take, and then maybe the pain will go away in a few weeks. That's not helping people. Or if they get the MRI and they say, the degeneration of my disc is just amazing. And I'm like, yeah, right. Mine too. But I'm still moving, you know. So anyway, PTs have to take on the idea of promoting this movement system. I mean, they can't wait for everybody else to say it. I think they have to try to do exams, and I think we have to work hard on labels, and they've got to know that they have expertise in exercise. I mean, I'll probably offend everybody, but I am not a fan of PTs advertising that they're a Pilates person. I mean, I don't know why Pilates gets credit for inventing abdominal exercises. I've had incidents where doctors have said, well, you could go to a Pilates class or you can go to a physical therapist. You know, it's like, oh, right, they've got 4 years of education and they really understand this problem just because it's Pilates. And then when we identify ourselves as doing Pilates, and I know why it happens, it's because physical therapists don't know enough about exercise, so they go try to learn a routine instead of using all the anatomy and kinesiology that they were supposed to learn in school and applying that. In some ways, we have to change tradition. We have to, as you say, we're doctors now. We learn so much. We don't know what it is we're really about. And I think that's a good and bad. And sometimes getting back to the basics and getting focused on our real claim to fame, which is, how do you move? Is it right? Are you going down the right path? Is your exercise program appropriate? And letting people know they need to do an exercise program. And I think if we can also promote the idea that musculoskeletal pain is not a self-limiting condition and that we can help modify pain in ways that don't have side effects, et cetera, would be huge.
That's big. Shirley, you have got me fired up to run out of here and change the world right now. This is great to hear. It's great to hear from someone who's been around as long and seen as much and still says this is what we need to do. And you're still essentially beating the same drum saying this is it. And I hope now the message is really catching on.
Well, if people like you help spread the word amongst the young community, you know, not that I want to do an analogy at all, but the power of people in school, like I'm in St. Louis, Missouri, and you probably heard on the news at the University of Missouri.
Yeah, with the football team.
But students, you know, I mean, of course, we don't have a football team. That's probably our problem. If we had a football team, we could put more pressure on people. But it's you all realizing, you, the students coming along, you're getting the education. And if you, here's the sad part, is that every study in the world shows that students practice like their clinical experience. I understand the reasons, the pressure for productivity, you're not super efficient when you first get out, et cetera, et cetera. But realizing that you get that education because it's like has a reason for it. And all those things that the people are teaching you are really to be valued. I'm the first to understand how challenging it will be, but I know our business model's got to change and our practice model's got to change. And it's the right thing to do. That's the other part. This is the right thing to do because our contributions to healthcare could be truly amazing, truly amazing.
Wow, words to live by. I like that a lot. I'm ready to go. I'm ready to go out there and treat patients right now. It's a little late here, but I'll do it. All right. So an episode here, we call it a pint. So before we leave, we do shots. So just a small piece of advice. So if you're going to say something to PT students or maybe PTs have just graduated, fresh PTs, what's one piece of advice or one clinical pearl of wisdom you usually give to students to make sure that they keep it with them?
Just really learn how to analyze movement. Can I just have two little
pieces? You can have two. You're Shirley Salmon. You can have two.
Oh, yeah, right. I think the other thing is to really, I don't want to use the expression I usually use on this, but to really be looking for things that are inconsistent. Don't just, because somebody says long is weak and short is strong, don't believe it. Just make sure that what you see and what you're doing meets your own internal criteria. Don't take anybody's word for it. As such, you know, to me, evidence-based practice is only for that minute. And as someone who has seen and experienced the consequences of the best practices at a time, like I was on hormone replacement therapy until you get something in your boob, and then you know that wasn't the best thing to be doing. Or I have patients that are on the anti-osteoporosis medication until their jaws are deteriorated. So it's all good to know, but the most important thing is mechanisms, and you really want to know how it works. Our forte is kinesiology. Learn it, apply it, keep looking at, you know, I know muscles don't take kinesiology, so figure out how they're trying to get around it. Okay, that's more than I'm supposed to get.
But that's more than a shot, but I'll take it right here. Well, hey, that has been inspirational and really informative, and I'm ready to go change the world. I think I'm even more excited about what PT can do right now, so thank you very much.
It's huge. Keep it up, Jimmy.
Thanks, Shirley, thanks very much for talking with us in the PT Pinecast. We appreciate all your work.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Like what you hear? Leave us a review on iTunes. It's not like our moms can keep giving us 5 stars every day. Or can they? The PT Pinecast is intended for educational purposes only. No clinical decision-making should be based solely on one source. While care is taken to ensure accuracy, factual errors can be present. Our lawyers made us read that.